Welcome to MGO Radio 6.3 live from social distancing. I'm Brian Cook.
I'm Seth Fisher, and I think we're on 6.2 because we started on zero.
Oh, well, yeah, well. our numbering system is just totally destroyed this year. Speaking of totally destroyed, Michigan State. Well, Michigan cornerbacks.
Yeah, everything else seemed fine. Actually, I wanted to talk about our sponsors first because they're...
Oh, yeah, that would be a good thing to start with.
Yeah, and they're so great. We have Underground Printing and the Bose Store are the presenting sponsors. Our associate sponsors are Homeshore Lending, Ann Arbor Elder Law, the Residency in Ann Arbor Downtown, the University of Michigan Alumni Association, Michigan Law Grad, Human Element, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, and Information Entropy.
We usually kick these off with a brief look back at the previous game, no matter how painful it happened to be, after I got an opportunity to go extremely in-depth. This week's version of that is going to be among the less informative versions, just because it's not much of a secret what happened on defense. Anybody who watched the game can tell you exactly what the two major problems were, and those, of course, were cornerbacks not named Jamon Green and playing the 3-3-5 as a run defense.
Yeah, so, I mean, how was the play other than that, Mrs. Lincoln?
Manuel Excel on Twitter, who's a very smart guy that everybody should follow, had a comment along the lines of, yeah, these guys can't really run, but also they looked like they hadn't been coached since last September. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, there might be an element of truth to that depending on who got put where after the Shoop thing happened. But also I feel like, when you feel physically overmatched, your brain gets going a million miles an hour and you lose your technique. Similar thing happened in the Wisconsin game last year with the defensive tackles. Mm-hmm. So they knew that if they didn't go 100 miles an hour, they were going to get crushed. So what happened is that they went 100 miles an hour and then Wisconsin ran draws at them and they were just gone.
Right.
So they didn't have the confidence. They didn't have the ability to check what was happening before they committed to a course of action. And I feel like you saw that on a couple instances with Gray, most notably the screen that got called back where he's mm-hmm. should be crack replacing, but he's so concerned about keeping up with this hypothetical mesh route that he's just gone. Mm-hmm. So it just felt like, you know, a combination of these guys aren't Jordan Lewis, they aren't David Long physically, and then I think they panicked and they fell over a lot. That was so bad.
I mean, if we're like at the end of another Ohio State game and Chris Olave is doing this to them, it's like, well, you just don't have the talent to keep up with those guys. The thing is, I watched Jalen Naylor and I watched Ricky White, and those guys have some speed, but you know, they're not elite speed. Jalen Naylor has good speed. And that's all
Jalen
they have.
Jalen Naylor is definitely that's like his one major talent.
Yes, he is a speedy guy. But he does not adjust well to a ball in the air. He doesn't really catch anything that's tested. He just runs fast in one direction. And that's their one strength, and Michigan's playing to their strength. That was what was driving me nuts. Like, if you got to have a plan for the team you're going to face. And I thought, and I know you didn't get to the offensive UFR, or just didn't get it up, but like I thought on offense, it was the same problem. Michigan went into this game thinking, oh, we can just beat them.
And to me, the problems on offense were different because they were worrying about being physically overmatched. They just had a ton of missed assignments in the run game particularly. Mm-hmm. So Klatt had a couple of replays, and this was a theme for more than just the things he put on replay, is that you have two Michigan players going for the same guy. Often Ben Mason and either the puller or an offensive tackle. And I don't know if that's on Mason or if it's on the OT. I think it's sort of both in that situation, because sometimes it might be Mason, sometimes it might be the other guy. But they seemed unprepared for fairly basic gap switches by defenders. So, mm-hmm. you know, a defensive end shuffles down. Last week against Minnesota, they were keeping that guy outside the whole time. This time, Michigan State doesn't want that to happen. They want to spill it. So they have that defensive end crash down, and then both guys go to the defensive end. There's a free linebacker. You don't get any yards. And I don't know what to do with that because, you know, Ben Mason's been around a while.
Yeah.
And all these offensive linemen have been around a while, and they should have faced that in practice a lot. They shouldn't be messing it up virtually every time. So it's, you know, just kind of go back to the overall feel the program where they're a B plus program, and then they have issues with being organized on a consistent basis. Another thing that leapt out on defense is that when Michigan State went tempo, Michigan was terrible at getting lined up. So I think the first touchdown on Jamon Green was tempo. Michigan did not have a deep safety. And if Rocky Lombardi had come off his first read, he had a slot receiver running wide open for a touchdown. So, and they went tempo on that 92-yard touchdown drive at the end of the game and consistently caught Michigan out, unable to line up. And this has been a thing that has happened in the whole Harbaugh era, right? They don't get lined up on tempo. They occasionally get lucky. They got lucky on that third down because Barrett was not in position. He was running at the line of scrimmage at the snap, which took him right to a tackle who he blew through. And that's obviously dangerous if it's a pass, right? Because he's going the wrong direction and he's not going to be able to cover whoever runs by him. So sometimes they stumble into something where it works well for them. But I don't think it's any different than it was a couple years ago when Michigan couldn't do anything quickly, either on offense or defense.
And they had that four-minute drive at the end where they basically lost their opportunity to have a second drive unless they kick an onside. And then, I mean, even the onside was like, you know, they screw around for forever and then, you know, and then they just blip it. And the same thing happened with their Haskins package where, like, it looked like they put it in, but they hadn't practiced it enough that, like, okay, first of all, you have a Haskins at quarterback already. You don't need to replace that guy. Second of all, if you're going to do it, get out and do it. Don't, like, get out there and then, like, you know, have a bunch of seconds where, like, even the cameraman is on your quarterback watching him say, hey, we're changing, we're switching up. And then, like, take 25 seconds to get it right. And then use another play call on it, too. Like, that goes back to the organization you're talking about. And it also goes back to, like, how prepared were they for Michigan State? Like, the things that I see when I write those FIFO film things should not be things that, like, the program misses. That's, like, a very, you know, quick view, I watched a game and clipped a few things thing. It's not somebody watching deep analysis. If I notice it and they don't have an answer for it, that's where I get really frustrated.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a lack of preparation specifically for Michigan State or if it was just the idea that we're going to be able to do this thing that we say our program does. And that's man coverage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is probably not a Michigan State specific issue. It's this is what our defense is built around doing, and now it can't do it, and now what?
Mm-hmm.
We saw that they went too high for most of the second half, and they had various zone opportunities, and they didn't play them well. So there's Josh Ross, who's underneath a crossing route on a waggle, who stops and turns an unsuccessful play into a first down for Michigan State. There's another waggle where Dax Hill activates, comes down on the intermediate receiver, but isn't actually anywhere near him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you rep zone over and over again, I don't know if those things happen, but it's tough to do everything, especially in college football when your hours are relatively limited.
And so it takes forever to get, I mean, the teams that are good at zone rarely are playing true freshman safety. You might get away with one at cornerback, but you don't have like a true sophomore at safety because you can't plug and play guys. You have to get a feel for like where your zone is and where to go to after someone leaves your zone. And like you can see players all the time who are new at it because they just back up. They don't know what to do, so they back up and they get more space. And you know, if you're going to be a zone team, you have to commit to it. You have to practice that a lot and then have guys that you've recruited for that and have guys that are you know, ready to play it. And if they were, like, preparing older guys to play zone, right, if they had, like, you know, Vincent Gray was a good zone player, and then they had dudes that they could put in and play man, like, even that would be better than this, which is, like, okay, we can't do this, and now what are we going to do, scrap our defense in the middle of the season?
Well, they've done it the last 2 years with their running game. I mean, that's not a joke.
True,
they scrapped their run game mid-season last year. They scrapped their run game mid-season the year before. This seems to be a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really expect it to stop happening. This is very much a game changer for my opinion of where the program is and where it's likely to go. Just can't lose to a 3-touchdown underdog who can only really do one thing on offense unless you go to a 3-3-5, which, again, 6 yards an attempt on runs up the middle for Minnesota last week, 5.7 this week, and runs against Michigan's base set averaged 2.4 yards.
Right, which so is Michigan State's more, average.
You're more than doubling the number of average yards per run by putting out a 3-3-5 on a standard down, and you know it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You've watched it not work for 3-4 years now, and you don't even have like a tenuous justification for trying it because you don't have Josh Uche on the team anymore. And you go back and you look at a lot of these plays where there's, you know, Donovan Jeter, who's almost head up on the center, and Quiddy Pay's in a wide nine. So you've got a huge gap to one side of the line, and there's no linebacker help coming. So there's guys blitzing from the other side of the line. Josh Ross is sitting there, not doing anything. So frequently, it feels like that's just how it's supposed to be. So you've got Donovan Jeter, who's okay this year, maybe. We don't really have enough evidence to say that either way. But you have him taking a play-long double team from anybody. It's going to be very difficult for him to hold up, and then you have no support. So those runs are 5 or 6 yards, even if Quiddy Pay makes a play. Mm-hmm. And I just don't understand. You've had so much evidence that this is not a run defense. Your defensive tackles are recovered from last year to an extent where you're able to play Michigan State straight up and have great success against their ground game, and you're still throwing away downs running a 3-3-5 on a standard down. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, he's spoken on it before. When he had that, he gave that presentation in Texas. I forget the name of the coaching clinic. But, like, they put it online afterwards, and it's still out there. You can. But he talked about why he likes to go to his 3-3-5 fronts, and it's because he wants to be hard to prepare for. And he likes to surprise you where he can come from. The problem is not the 3-3-5 itself. The 3-3-5 is an okay defense. It's just about how much it's the same thing as zone defense. It's how much you commit to it and whether you have the players to run it. If you want to play a 3-3-5, you need to show up in gaps that they're not expecting. And because it just becomes whack-a-mole. It's like find the gap, right? And you're asking the offense to try to guess at all these different gaps and see if they can find the one before they accidentally go into the one that has two defensive tackles running into it. It's a really fun defense to watch, but he doesn't run it like that. He runs it like a 4-3. So he's I'm going to send this guy at this gap, and he gets caught by pre-snap motion, and there you are.
Even like the classic 3-3-5s are usually underdog defenses, like it was popular at Mississippi State, popular at San Diego State. These are not high-end defenses. You don't see Bama doing it. You don't see Clemson doing it.
Yeah,
It's a defense for making up for your physical deficiencies, which was the case last year. Michigan had a reasonable reason to go after it because they were in that position on their defensive line. They are no longer. Excuse me, there's a cat. And it's just really frustrating to watch Michigan State rip off a 28-yard run because the converted fullback tipped a blitz and got blown out so that there's a huge gap right up the middle where he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, people are muttering about firing Don Brown online now, and it's just like, if he's in his fourth year here and the cornerback situation looks like it does and Michigan gives up 60 points to Ohio State again, sorry, cat, I don't know how you keep him. You can't keep a defensive coordinator who's given up 150 points to Ohio State over the course of 3 years. You can't do it.
The disconnect between the coach that coaches talk about, Don Brown is a legend in coaching circles. And, like, if you go on coach Twitter, they love to, like, use him examples all the time. The Minnesota game got them all excited because he did some cool stuff again, and everyone wanted to talk about the stuff that Don Brown was doing against Minnesota's RPO because he had an interesting response to Minnesota's RPOs that nobody came up with last year. And that Don Brown should be a defensive coordinator in college. And that's the Don Brown we were really excited about. And, like, there was a comment, I think, on your UFR. It killed me. I think it was by Dragon Child, in fact, where he's like, I think that Brady Hoke ruined Don Brown because he left all these great defensive tackles and convinced him he could just play his straight-up stuff. And it took away all of the interesting things he used to do. His Boston College defenses were, like, fascinating because guys were blitzing from everywhere, right? Remember Dr. Blitz? And, like, it was hard even to get a ball, even to get the things that they had, even though they had those fly routes, because you never knew where people were going to fly out of. You never knew what zones they were going to run.
I can't agree with that. Like, Michigan was getting a ton of pressure in this game, but because Rocky Lombardi's first read was always right, it didn't matter. So I went into the in the game column, I was like, what happened to the pressure in this game? And it turned out when I actually went and looked in the video that Hutchinson and Pay were consistently getting around at 8 yards. They were consistently about to hit the quarterback, but because he was able to get the ball out immediately every time on his first read, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So Michigan didn't need to blitz in this game. It wasn't a requirement because they were getting to the quarterback with four guys, sometimes five guys. And because you're so terrible at recruiting cornerbacks over the past 4 years, it just doesn't matter. Because if Ambry Thomas is on this team, Michigan State scores 4 points, five, maybe. Mm. So and it's unfortunate for Michigan that Thomas decided to opt out, but you have no corner depth. This was going to happen next year if it didn't happen this year. And you could kind of see it coming too, because Michigan top 100 guy Jordan Lewis, top 50 guy David Long, top 100 guy LaVert Hill, like top 100 guy Ambry Thomas. They had this string of corners, and corner is one of the positions that translates the most from high school to college. Like, that is right. All about athleticism. The camps are super useful because they're just doing the stuff that they're going to be doing in college. It's a very projectable position. And Michigan, I mean, Jamon Green's a four-star, but Vincent Gray is a guy who is like 20th in the state headed to Mizzou. You know, Jalen Perry was a four-star who dropped a lot and got decommitted by Georgia. And sometimes guys who are kind of high up there and committed and kind of start falling don't fall enough. I think that's probably the case here. So you have these kind of fringe four-star types that it's like, can that guy actually go to the school he claimed his offers for? And
you keep pointing out, like, you know, I hate to make it down to 40 times, but the 40 times are the things that stand out with these guys. And so they did recruit some guys who seemed to be more athletic, but then they lost them. Ben St. Juste is an all Big Ten player for Minnesota. Keith Washington stuck around for years at West Virginia. I guess he would have been gone now this year, but who else did they lose? Spider, remember that guy? Like, he was supposed to be high four-star. So they had guys when they came in, I thought, and then for whatever reason, I hope it wasn't because Vincent Gray was passing them, is what I'm saying.
He's the guy who got the snaps last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was the third cornerback last year. So he's been the third best corner for as a redshirt freshman. I mean, what do you do with that? Because you could kind of see this coming last year, too.
Yeah.
So after the Notre Dame game, I posted various routes where Gray and Ambry Thomas were trying to defend the same guy on the same route, and Ambry Thomas is putting him in the sideline, and Chase Claypool is, like, one-handed catches and stabbing in a foot and doing all kinds of stuff that he's currently doing in the NFL.
Right.
And with Gray, like, he's panic interfering, and then when he's not panic interfering, the ball is 3 yards in field because it can be, because he didn't put it in the sideline. And we saw that with Dax Hill. So in the third quarter, they tried Dax Hill on two different slot fades, and we're all hyped up about Dax Hill being able to defend slot fades because that changes what you can do on your defense, and he can. Mm-hmm. Now, Jaden Reed is the most dangerous receiver that Michigan State has. They run him on two slot fades. They're both incomplete, and Dax Hill is in the guy's hip pocket in both. On the second one, he puts him in the sideline. He's so close. Like, they're on the sideline already. They both go up for the ball. Dax doesn't get it, but he bumps the guy out of bounds.
Right.
So I just want a time machine so I can go put Dax Hill on the defense 3 years ago or 2 years ago where that was, like, the big problem. And then it's like, oh, well, now we get to do all the cool stuff. We get to beat Ohio State. We get to go to the playoff. Yeah, but he's on this defense, so he's probably not going to see a target for the rest of the year.
Can he clone?
Is this depressing enough for you?
I'm trying to see a silver lining. Like, you know, say Air Wright is going to be on campus in a couple weeks. Maybe they get that guy, and maybe Jamon Green. I don't understand where the talent identification has been at. If Jamon Green is a guy who can play, and he wasn't a four-star, he was like a high three-star that, like, only Texas and Michigan were really interested into that guy. But the Michigan was super into that guy, so much that we took his twin brother, right? Like,
yeah.
So, and that guy is a guy who apparently had the chops athletically to play. And they were putting all this time into Vincent Gray. Now, I want to make a distinction between Vincent Gray and Brandon Watson. Because Watson was a good player who just got beat when it got to, like, Ohio State level. But everyone else he was able to survive against, right? And I think he would have survived against Michigan State because he knows how to control a Jalen Naylor coming out of his stance. And by the time the ball gets up, that guy's been put to the sideline twice. And, you know, maybe he tugs a little bit, but it wasn't like desperation tugging. He was crafty. He was good at that. And maybe that's been some great future.
He's able to jam guys, right? That was that was his specialty. And none of Michigan State's wide receivers got jammed in this game by anybody. Like,
exactly.
Not even Jamon did it. Like, because they're afraid, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid that if they get up into a guy and they try to jam him and it doesn't go well, that they're never going to catch up, which is probably accurate. But then you're not really playing press coverage anymore.
And you're not talking about huge dudes. You're talking about a true freshman. And true freshman receivers suck because they get jammed all the time. And Jalen Naylor, who is just... I don't want to dump on the guy because he's, you know, a Big Ten football player. But he's not a guy who's supposed to beat you like that. He's jammable. And I think other teams are going to do that to
him. Kind of ability to get open downfield consistently prior in his career.
Right.
He's a guy who clearly had a lot of straight line speed, but didn't have the technique or the strength to utilize it on the outside. And Michigan didn't ask any questions along those lines. So we should stop talking about the defense. I'm sick of it.
I mean, the offense, I thought...
Let's stop talking about the offense.
Yeah, okay. Do we have anything good to report? Do you have anything nice to say about this game?
Well, you know, I think Joe Milton was put under a lot of duress, and the issues that he had were not necessarily all his fault, especially on the late drive, because guys were getting through up the middle so much because Michigan was terrible at picking up stunts that he had really on a lot of those plays he didn't have much of an option except to check down. So, you know, I kind of feel like he needs to unleash the dragon a little bit more. I was talking to Sam Webb on WCK, and I made an assertion that if Michigan hasn't gone deep on a fly route so far, and they've had 3 months of practice against these corners, it kind of feels like maybe he can't do that and they can't hit deep shots. And Sam's like, no, they hit a lot of deep shots. So I'm like, all right, well, let's see it.
Yeah,
they're gonna have to do that. So he was able to hit a lot of tight NFL windows in this because Michigan State was able to compress the field. And, you know, his accuracy is better than I expected it to be. You know, sometimes, especially on 5-yard slants or whatever, he does get 100 miles an hour too much. But, you know, he's leaps and bounds where I expected him to be. You know, I didn't understand the offensive game plan here. Like, they didn't attack the flats. They didn't really use QB run game.
And they had them. And they had such a talent disparity on the outside. Like, the Blake Corum touchdown, that's him.
Oh, yeah.
That's, like, three guys that Corum just, like, puts his foot in the ground and goes around, including a cornerback.
Oh, yeah, Michigan screwed up the blocking on that one, too, and Corum just, like, don't matter.
Yeah.
So you had a bunch of opportunities, and you didn't really take advantage of them. And Josh Gattis is coming off 8 straight games where I thought his game plans were good to great. This one, not so much. Can we stop talking about this game and just memory hole it at this point?
I can. Do you want me to hit the ad break button?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that.
Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of 5-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGo Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go! Let's go!
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
During these challenging times, it is important to have a Michigan man in your corner.
If you or someone in your life has questions, concerns, or just want to discuss your legal rights, give attorney Jonathan Paul a call at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com. John asks you all to be safe. We're going to get through this together. And as always, go blue.
Win or lose this season, stop into Information Entropy and make sure that you have a good time on game day. First-time customers can light up a free pre-roll and enjoy the quality cannabis products that this shop has to offer. Located 2 miles away from the big house and accessible to ages 21 plus, find Information Entropy at 1115 Broadway, across from the Kellogg Eye Center off Plymouth Road. They don't want to hear the words go green over there, but they are happy to help you smoke it. Check them out at Information Entropy.
Hippie boy, ride in the sand. Let my baby hold your hand. Give me the time of day, baby. When we find my love for you. Tell me that you love me. When you cry alone. Tell me that you love me.
Welcome back to MGRO Radio 6.2, live from social distancing. We're going to talk Indiana now. The Hoosiers are ranked 13th after a stirring top 10 overtime victory against Penn State, where they were outgained by 300 yards.
And they have a t-shirt for this now. they have a t-shirt with the football on the pylon. And the t-shirt, I noticed the football is much further into the pylon than it was in the actual picture.
Artistic license. They deserve it.
Bless you, Indiana.
So I only watched the Penn State game. I wasn't able to take in their game against Rutgers because I might have been pissed off or something. But in that Penn State game, as mentioned, Penn State badly outgained them. Penix didn't really look like the Penix we saw last year, who was a 70% completions guy. He was under 50% for most of the game. I saw some Indiana fans speculating if Jalen Ramsey would be in the game if he was still in Bloomington, and they all kind of thought, yeah. And then Nick Sheridan's their new offensive coordinator. Their play sequencing that game was horrendous.
Yes.
They spent every first down running Stevie's got for between 1 and 3 yards. Almost literally, I think, every first down. I think there might have been a 1 or 2, but it was not. It was Lloyd era.
Yeah.
But they have a salty secondary somehow. Tom Allen's put that defense together, and they generally tend to outperform their talent level. And most alarmingly for Michigan, Wap Fillier is fast.
And available. Have we actually faced him yet?
And available.
Do we have any pictures of Wap actually playing Michigan yet? Because I think he's been injured a couple times when he's been when we've come up.
Know.
Yeah.
But so how likely is this team just to pull the same thing Michigan State did?
Well, I mean, Indiana likes to throw deep. That's kind of their thing. And I think that at the beginning of the season, their receivers were going to be a lot better than State's receivers. I mean, Wap is their he's their slot guy, but they're Indiana. They have a whole bunch of skinny 6'2 dudes that send down the sideline. And I don't know if you noticed about Michigan's defense and defense in those plays, but it's hard to judge them because, you know, Penn State was actually having to, they got away with it, but they were grabbing them a whole bunch in order to stop that. Ty Freifogel he's not a dude. He doesn't jump particularly high, but he's a B-plus player, and if that's all you need, then obviously, until Michigan can stop fly routes, there's nothing else to talk about.
Well, Indiana doesn't have that 6'3" guy who's a little ponderous but just a bear to deal with this year, right?
Nick Westbrook? No, I think after 8 years, that guy is finally gone.
Well, I mean, they had a whole sequence of them, and they have another one kind of in the pipeline, but he's a true freshman out of Detroit named Raekwon Williams.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not right.
I don't remember what his name. He's not playing yet.
That's a Michigan State defensive tackle.
Yeah. and an Alabama defensive tackle, if you spell it differently.
he's in that kind of genre of name. We're going to just say that. So, but they're kind of on the fast and speedy side, and that might be a relief most years, but doesn't really give me the warm fuzzies right now.
So A couple things. One, I haven't seen Penix actually lob very many balls. Like his downfield accuracy is very similar to Joe Milton's, where he just has the arm and he can flick it out there really fast. But everything he throws is 100 miles an hour. And you could see, especially against Penn State, that his receivers are a little way too used to Peyton Ramsey. Because like they stop and they wait, like they've got like some time for the ball to arrive, and then all of a sudden it gets there and they're in the wrong spot. They're just not used to judging the vast differential between how hard those two guys throw. But he gets it there. And at the end of that Penn State game, really what it was Penix just fitting it into tiny windows and his guys managing to bring a couple of them in. And that is kind of terrifying because that can beat anybody. On the other hand, it's, you know, tight windows is hard. But he's certainly capable of it. I don't think Sheridan is doing a great job of using him quite. I think that's been a theme this year, and IU fans are certainly onto it. But they haven't been running it with him. He can run, but I think he's got, five or six keepers all year. And it's not part of the offense. Like they run RPOs. They don't run zone reads. Or if they run zone reads, it's belly plays, and he doesn't keep it even when he should.
Well, his stats from last year versus this year are pretty stark at this point. So last year, 8.7 yards an attempt, 69% completion, 10 touchdowns, 4 interceptions. You know, that did kind of the degree of difficulty there was a little bit lower because he got injured early in the season. So he had, he got to play Ball State and EIU, mm-hmm. and then Michigan State, Rutgers, Maryland, and Northwestern. So he didn't really, go up against the cream of the cream. So that might have been a little bit inflated. But this year, 58%, 6.6 yards an attempt, 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. He's been sacked 4 times. He's only sacked once all last year. So there's some hesitancy going on. And then those offensive tackles, I was trying to caution people that Quiddy Pay blowing up Indiana's offensive tackles last year said more about their offensive tackles than Quiddy Pay. Pleased to be wrong about that, but those offensive tackles were also completely overrun by Penn State. So if Michigan is able to cover read one, I think Penix is going to be in some issues, some difficulty.
Yeah. He is pretty good at – he is because he's been under a lot of pressure. And the middle of the offensive line is kind of weak, so he's getting someone pushed into his lap at the same time that his left tackle is completely whiffing on somebody. And he's pretty good at just kind of like backing out and just like chucking off his back foot and actually getting a good pass off. So it's hard, that second read's going to get out. I'm surprised he hasn't had as many interceptions, and I think that just might be luck. I think there have been a couple drops, and he puts in the guy's chest more often than I think he's getting credit for. Against Penn State, that didn't happen as much just because they were playing a little bit back, and they were, playing to come up and hit. And that's, I don't think that's going to be Michigan's strategy so much. But yeah, I think you can get pressure on him, but again, you got to get that first read covered.
Yeah, and then their ground game has not been inspiring so far. Penix not really involved. His total of 10 carries on the air. Of course, half of those are sacks, so he's only carried the ball 5 times. And then Stevie Scott is averaging about just over 3 yards a carry.
And he's getting one of those yards himself. Because he's a big dude, and he's gotten, I think, another 10 pounds on him from last year, and he was a load to bring down before. But he's getting hit right at the beginning. Because they're not running anything that kind of opens up for him. They're in the middle of the offensive line. I didn't sign anybody because of last week, and I'm not signing any offensive lines until Michigan actually can make use of that. But it's not that different than Michigan State, not as bad as Michigan State. But I think that they're kind of at their floor of what their offensive line was going to be this year. They don't really pull a lot of guys. It's just kind of outside zone or inside zone or belly. And really, those kind of plays come down to whether you can win or not. So if Carlo Kemp is pushing these guys back, Michigan can actually use the defensive ends as defensive ends, and that's it for the running game.
And then on defense, they actually did a really good job of holding down Penn State's ground game, except for Sean Clifford, who had 119 yards without even accounting for sacks. and had a 35-yard winding touchdown run that didn't really seem like it belonged to the same player that Sean Clifford is.
Well, if you watch that play and you watch linebacker number 4 instead of watching Clifford, it suddenly makes entire like total sense. Especially after you've been watching that guy for the entire game, because he probably had his worst game, but he also had a very Vincent Gray kind of game for them. And, you know, they have other guys that they can put in there, but they don't know how to pass pro at all, so they're kind of stuck with him at this moment. Jones is his name. So as long as that's going on, the way that they're answering it is they take their defensive tackles and kind of fan them out into the B gaps and then just run a linebacker down the middle, hoping that he can take out the center and like basically two gap by having a lot of momentum. And all Penn State was doing is just riding that guy into the backfield, and then you have a great big wide open gap to run the quarterback. And you run a couple games with your running back to get the linebacker. Yep, you know, if there's one linebacker still there, he runs off with your running back, and that's it. That's kind of where I see Michigan attacking them too. But you got to play some backyard football against these guys, because they're going to, you know, they're going to run at you, and they're going to blitz you from different angles, and you kind of have to just see where your outlet is and do something with it.
And with Marcelino Ball out, that's their Viper / spacebacker guy who was probably their best player on defense. You know, Tywan Mullen's back for his sophomore year. He's an excellent cornerback. But, you know, there's not another name that really jumps off the page to you as a guy like, oh, yeah, they've got that guy. And, you know, they were able to hold up against Penn State on the ground mostly. And then Rutgers is just not really much of a test. They annihilated Vedrill. They annihilated that whole offense.
Yeah, they only stayed in Penn State game because they were blitzing the edges so much, and Penn State was trying to run a bunch of zone reads and whatnot to get their to attack. And so like if they were doing that same blitz, you remember the Don Brown blitz against Notre Dame when he was with Boston College, where the quarterback and the running back get hit the same exact time. He ran that same blitz a couple times, and his player screwed it up once, and it was like a moment. I was like, oh my god. But like Allen's got some really cute ways of messing with your run game, and that's why I think that, you know, you're going to leave the quarterback run open if you do that stuff all the time. And basically, as soon as Penn State figured that out, I think they ran 8 quarterback draws of different variants, and they might have averaged 12 yards a play. So
this is a team that did a good job beating Rutgers, eked out a Penn State game in overtime where they are the there's one other team that got outgained as badly as Indiana and still won the game, and it's another Indiana game.
chaos team
over the past like 15 years. So like, this isn't the number 13 team in the country, but after what happened to Michigan against Michigan State, you got to be cautious about putting any expectations on it, because it looks like Michigan has a position group that is just asking to get beat up on, and they're going to adjust. Mm-hmm. They're going to play off coverage. They're going to play a bunch more zone that they're probably not going to be very good at. They're going to ask Penix to find guys in windows. It's probably going to be hit or miss just based on his form this year. And then, you know, on the other side of the ball, it's like, all right, can Joe Milton get something explosive going? Can Michigan effectively use his legs? Because that's another thing from the Michigan State game, which I know we've memory hold, but very few quarterback runs, very few reads of any variety. So that makes me think that they're protecting his decision making.
And you cannot do that against Indiana, because if you turn Joe Milton's back to Indiana, because they're blitzing from all different angles. They're blitzing cornerbacks. They're bringing the safeties down and blitzing them. They play a ton of zone defense. So he needs to be looking at the defense and seeing what he's got. You have to play backyard football against these guys. And I mean, they've embraced the chaos. Like, give Tom Allen credit. He doesn't have that great of a unit. Like, his defensive tackles are terrible. He's got that one linebacker who's unplayable and doesn't have anyone he can replace him with. He's got a couple of good cornerbacks, but if he goes to the third cornerback, that guy's garbage. And same thing with the safeties. You know, you take out a safety for a minute, and then your backup is a guy who, I think he was on the field for like 5 snaps, and one of them was that great bit, that long pass to Jahn Dotson at the end. So, like, they're going to play chaos, and he's kind of embraced the chaos in his defense. And, you know, if Michigan can mess with the chaos and just kind of and roll with it, I think it's going to be a really fun game. And if they can't, then it's going to get ugly and angry pretty fast.
Well, you know, back in the day when I used to do the blog poll, there was a certain pattern that we found whenever we judge people's votes is that whenever their team had just lost in a really depressing fashion, that the bloggers for that team would underrate their own team very badly. I think we're kind of in that spot with Michigan right now. Michigan's cornerbacks aren't going to play that badly going forward. If they will, they'll be replaced by someone else, maybe Green Warren, maybe Andre Selden. If the current foursome that's competing for the job isn't up for it. So I feel like people are a little bit too down in regards to this specific game just because, I mean, they saw the terrible thing happen. Obviously, that resets our season expectations. But the line on this game is, I think, Michigan by 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
At least it was at one point. I don't know where it's moved recently. And, you know, that feels reasonable to me. I feel like Michigan should probably win this game, but obviously it's nothing is certain. Nothing is certain.
I mean, if Michigan is roughly equivalent to Penn State, and I think we probably have to take us down a notch just because of that quarterback situation. But Penn State, if Michigan's talent level, you know, if they can solve that piece, right, then the rest of it is kind of Penn State-ish, and Indiana was hugely lucky not to get, you know, not to lose this game by 20 or 30 points. So there was just a lot of crazy that went on in this game. And then, you know, they played a competitive game with Rutgers, which they just kind of took command of later in the game. I don't know that this is an Indiana juggernaut. I don't know if this is a number 13 team. It's like Michigan is going to see if they're a ranked team or not in this game. And then we'll go.
Well, I mean, the thing that you have to be concerned about if you're Indiana is you only picked up, you know, 300 and change yards offense against Rutgers. Defensively, their performance was just fine, right? They held Vedral to 3.8 yards in an attempt, picked him off 3 times, gave up 1 long run to the backup running back, and then pretty much shut Rutgers down in every other respect. So, you know, their defense did what it needed to do against Rutgers, kind of got stretched against Penn State, and then their offense not being able to crack 400 yards against the Scarlet Knights is perhaps concerning for them.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Maybe Rutgers just has a good defense this year because those defensive tackles get upfield so fast and they've got some decent corners. But I would guess that Indiana has some major holes in their front seven. And this, I mean, if the only game I can imagine it coming into is, like, remember that game, was it 2013, the Jeremy Gallen game?
Yeah.
Where, like, neither team can stop each other because they both just have, like, a glaring weakness that you can attack at will. That's, yeah.
Well, I think we've exhausted all the content we have on the Indiana Fighting Hoosiers, so we're going to take a break and come back with a special guest, hopefully. We're not sure yet.
He's on.
Hey, so I have, like, insurance and stuff, but I don't really, like, know what's going on with it.
Yeah, your coverage probably sucks, and you're paying way too much for it. And I know this because I had a guy, his name's Phil Klein. He's actually a Michigan alum and wrestled for Michigan. He looked at my insurance, and he was like, yeah, your coverage sucks, and you're paying a lot more than you need to for it.
I also, like, I hesitate to even mention this, but I do have my insurance from a company that advertises during college football games.
Well,
and I wish that was not the case.
Well, why don't you just get it from a cool guy who actually, like, reads MGo Blog?
Well, how would I do that? They have a website?
They have one of those, too. It's philklineinsurance.com. Can you remember the name Phil Klein?
Sure.
Can you remember insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Use those two together, and you will save money on your insurance, and you will actually get better coverage on your home and your auto, and they do life, too.
All right. So you're telling me if I Google Phil Klein Insurance, this website will come up?
Yes.
Wonders never cease.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. Let's go.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages
$110,000.
It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across Southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Baby love, you're the sweetest gal I know. On the side of heaven, when you shed my dream, fall in love again, all over again.
Welcome back to MGO Radio 6.2, live from social distancing. We welcome in Rishi Narayan of UGP, Bowstore. What else? You got so many other things going on.
I know. It's a global pandemic, man. I'm just trying to survive, just like everybody else.
Yeah. So we've been running a series of shirts, speaking of helping people survive, for Ann Arbor institutions. We're not taking any of the cut. We're just selling some shirts so that some of these places can stay open. And maybe they'll reopen a couple of places that they recently closed, or I could go back to them one last time.
Yeah, no, it's all the we call them institutions because, you know, you really can't imagine an Ann Arbor without these places. By and large, the feedback has been awesome, and everyone's really appreciative and excited. And so you know, kudos and thanks to the whole MGO blog community for supporting.
Yeah. Seth, you had something to step in here.
Oh, I've learned a few things along the way too. Like, you know, it's been fun because I just end up writing about my personal experiences with all these places. Right. And then like you come in with like some sort of history, like Domino's came out of Dominic's. What's the story behind that?
Yeah, so the story behind that is a true story. I'll just give the quick abridged version, but you stole the punchline. Thanks for that. But the backstory. Thanks for ruining the story. Spoiler alert. But the backstory was.
Wait, I'll set you up differently. So Dominic spawned a multinational corporation.
funny you should mention that, Seth. So Dominic DeVardi, who is the namesake of Dominic's. He used to have a few locations in the Ann Arbor area, one of them, of course, being the famous Law Quad location, but a few others. One was in Ipsy, and he decided to sell the other locations to focus on the one in the Law Quad that we all know and love. And so he sold one of the locations to two brothers that worked for him there. Some time passed, and he was getting feedback that it tasted different than the pizza that he made, and sauce was different. Something was different. So he went to those two brothers, and he was like, I'm sorry, guys, you have to change your name. Like, I can't have people confusing it. And so they said, okay, and they changed the name to Domino's. They were the Monahan brothers, and some years later invented the pizza conveyor belt oven and revolutionized pizza as we know it and truly spotted it. And for a while on Domino's website, I don't know if it's still there, it said, like, started off from Dominic's in Ann Arbor. It was part of their story. So Dominic's is filled with all sorts of little tidbits and super interesting pieces of history. It really is a gem in the community, and it's sad that they've not been open the whole year.
Yeah, and people are pretty excited that, like, this is the first time they've actually been able to get a T-shirt from them ever. Or, like, I think somebody said they had, like, a tie-dye T-shirt from the 70s that Dominic sold, and, like, that's it. Like, they've never sold a T-shirt before.
I mean, they have had some shirts for sale, but I think that it's a very acquired taste of a design. I'll say it's, like, very old-school design, but, Rich DeVardi, who's the owner, Dominic's son, mm-hmm. was really excited to get a new shirt going, and, fast fact, I worked at Dominic's for a summer and a few football games, and it wasn't very long, but I did form some lasting friendships from that. And he has he has two sons, Mason and Dominic, and I think they're close to taking over, and so it's really a family business. So that's just an example of some of the institutions, quote unquote institutions, that trying to support and make sure we see them again next football season.
what is Dominic's like after a football game? I have never subjected myself to that madness.
Yeah. It wasn't too bad after football games, but I would say that because they don't have TVs, right?
Oh.
Still to this day, no TVs in Dominic's. Friday nights before were pretty crazy. However, if you everyone that recalls, Dominic's closes at 10. So it was never too late. It wasn't a 2 a.m. kind of thing.
And it's in a place that's like zoned for housing, right? It's just it's weird graveyard grandfather.
That may be the reason, but I'm pretty sure it's just because like we're out there, they do their thing, and it's like we don't stay open past 10. It's not that big of a deal for them.
Right. They really do feel like a real Italian place just kind of got plopped down in the middle of Ann Arbor, and they're like, no, we're still taking this time off, or we're gonna close in October and for the entire winter. Like that's the other thing. I don't think like they were being open for like by the time the Big Ten season was rolling around.
Annually, except for this year, closes on the Ohio State game. After the Ohio State game. So that's when it shuts down for the winter. And then I can't remember the day in spring that it opens, but I think it's something. And then, of course, that was historically, where the Hash Bash really took place, and Dominic's in the original kind of the Hash Bash, I think, that we think about was like right there on the street right in front of it.
And then and the other one that kind of got a lot of notoriety was the blind pig, because we ran that one week before Joe Biden decided to get in on it too.
He must have seen what the response was on your post and how you wrote it. It's like, this story is amazing, we gotta make this a national campaign.
I was getting tagged in tweets by like random political people in California and stuff, like, hey, this guy wrote about the down home place, and they have and then our t-shirt wasn't even for sale anymore because we only had it up for a week and we just taken it.
I know, we did. It wasn't the exception to the rule. We put it back up because it seemed like a disservice to the blind pig not to. But I mean, once again, another place where the stories that have come out of there are unreal. And if you, I had a chance to interview Jason Berry, who's their longtime a talent booker there, and we sat in the green room, and the stories were amazing, and it's another one of those locations. Like, I mean, they're not open. Trying to figure it out, and it is I think all support is important, but and obviously that's not necessarily something we think about with football season per se, but it is very much a part of the fabric of Ann Arbor. And so for alumni that left and gone, when they think of Ann Arbor and you think about, I mean, the Blind Pig comes up as this place, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, whatever, I mean, it's like part of the stories we tell.
Yeah, I think there are more people in the comments who said they were at the Nirvana concert than actually people could fit in the Blind Pig.
Yeah. Everyone, like, the capacity of the Blind Pig is not such to have held as many people as think that they were there. So, but it is, and it's still an awesome venue to go to for music. The last concert I went to there was a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers cover band, and it was awesome. So, I'm up for more cover bands. I'm going to tell Joe about that.
Yeah, there was a band. There was a Bear versus Shark, who I was like a big fan of when I was in college or like late college or whatever. And then it turned out like they were reading the blog, and so like they were going to do a reunion concert there. So I went to that like a few years ago. But before that, I think the last concert I'd been to there was the Eels, and like we were idiots and didn't realize that the Eels had blown up because of the movie Shrek. So we walk in, and like the only spot to stand is like, you curl around and go stand like by the bar. Like that was the only room there was, just because like it was just wall to wall people in there.
Were there people like donkey costumes? Were they like children? Like,
no, it's just like people found out, like people heard the song in the middle of the Shrek, and they're like, oh, I like that band. Let me check out their album. And then they, if they were at the Pig, they get,
Did anyone scream "Play All Star" at them? No,
I think that happens at every single concert, Brian. Every band gets "Play All Star."
The free bird of our day.
That's right.
Yeah, that is the free bird. I have been, you know, going back to the Ann Arbor Institution's, you know, campaign that we're working on. You know, we were pretty mindful of trying to do not just restaurants and not just bars, but event venues. You know, we highlighted the Michigan State Theater. You know, quintessential athletic things you think about when you think about athletics, like Spots. You know, Charlie's, etc. So Brown Jug, obviously, mm-hmm. in a namesake. You know, we have a few more that are coming, and you know, potentially we'll do a relaunch of some or all of them, because you know, we've got some comments like, when is this going back up? I missed it. So we're not gonna just you know, obviously this is going back to all of these establishments.
Yeah,
so
we should explain why we did that. It's because like, we can make the t-shirts really fast, get them out in a quick batch, and get the check to the venue as soon as possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, granted, we came up with the idea when it was a version 1.0 of the schedule, and right. You know, so like, you know, I thought I was so clever because I had like aligned the brown jug shirt to the Minnesota game right. when it was the original Minnesota game. Of course, that worked out poorly. So, so there was some strategy and thought to it, you know, and then it sort of went out the window, but you know. A lot of these establishments have a lot to deal with anyway, and so we didn't have everyone set and ready to go. And you know, there was some, you know, we thought it was exciting to like be able to launch one every week, and maybe looking back on it, we could have done it a different way. But I think at the end of the day, people have been pretty excited, and comments are great. We're seeing some requests that we might have to talk about off air.
There's a few I've gotten since that we wanted to add, and there were a few that we wanted to add that like just weren't reachable, or like, you know, said like, don't even bother because it's not going to happen.
We're still working, and you know, there are busier things to do. Some people don't know the power of MGO Blog. They don't know how how life changing it could be. So you know, we have some education to do.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, I think we should probably take a break. Come back, and we'll have our gimmicky top five.
We'll do.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of Homeshare Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homeshare Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our complicated loan. Brian used them, you should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homeshorelending.com. That's HOMESURE.com/MGOBlog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of 5-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide, because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGO Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide.
It can be a rough ride along the information superhighway. That's why we build our e-commerce websites tough enough to handle the load. With the capacity to take hundreds of simultaneous online transactions and the stability of load-balanced co-located server architectures, a website from Human Element performs in the roughest conditions. Thousands of products? No problem. We'll throw in the tools to manage them with precision and efficiency. All with a design slick enough to make you think your girlfriend might be impressed. So load it up and hit the gas, and let Human Element show you the way. Special offers available for returning lessees. Financing available with approved credit to qualified buyers. Client participation may affect savings. Optional equipment available at additional cost. See human-element.com for details.
Baby, please send me someone to love.
Baby, please send me someone to love. On this side of heaven, we cry this flowing moment.
Welcome back to MGO Radio 6.2 live from social distancing. It is now time for our gimmicky top five, which are gone but not forgotten places in Ann Arbor. Obviously, I've been here for, 24 years? Jesus.
I'm at 20, almost 20. 20?
Mm. Yeah, I see it. My problem is I lived there in college when I didn't have any money. So, like, I didn't get to experience a lot of the cool things, and I've had to kind of circle back and find them as an outsider when I, like, come into town for work or for game weekends and whatnot.
I'm pretty excited because we have not talked about what we picked, and I had to make my list three times as long because I was pretty sure you guys are going to pick stuff that I've picked, so...
Making my list thinking, like, okay, here are my favorite places and stuff that I loved in Ann Arbor back in the, like, 2000s or, like, 98 or whatever, and then I go online and it's, like, it's still there. So I'm like, oh.
Yeah, you did mention a couple things that I'm like, that's still there, man. That's existing.
I gotta get to, yeah. So I guess the Rajarani's changed their name, but they're still around.
It's still an Indian restaurant in the weird house that is Rajarani.
Right.
And it can never be anything but an Indian restaurant.
No, it's faded.
Yeah, that's part of the zoning.
And Amir's is still around too, and I haven't been there in 20 years now, so I definitely have to make it back there. I just imagined, like, you know, nothing survived on Northview's. I'm like, or on State Street. Like, why would that still be around? And I guess it did survive, and people love it. So I got to make it back.
You ready, yeah. Seth? You're number five.
I cheated for my number five and went to Ipsy for the Elbow Room because I do miss the Elbow Room a lot. We played there a whole bunch.
Something about it, perhaps.
We talked about the pig, but the pig was kind of hard to get into if you were an up-and-coming band, and Elbow Room had a good way of finding, like, bands that were just the right size for the Elbow Room, and you could just, if you had nothing else to do that night, you could go and whatever band was there would be, like, a good fit, and I got to play there a couple times. They'd always have some, like, goofy shows with, like, dudes dressed up in Spider-Man costumes and stuff, so, like, I don't know.
Was that you?
No, it was what? Athletic Mike League, who went on to become Mayor Hawthorne.
Yeah.
All right. Rishi, you're number five.
So here's the thing. I'm afraid you guys are going to steal mine, so I don't – the order is not of any importance, but I just want to make sure I get mine out. So
all right.
Just putting that out there. Number five is, I have to say, at Mills Sports Shop. It's birthplace of collegiate apparel. Part of the UGP family for some time and, you know, no longer, but still amazing stories in an Ann Arbor institution.
Yeah, I have a
long
honorable mention list, and Moses at the top of that one, too. I figured we'd have to, like, go through, because the list got too long for us to, like, leave them all off. But, yes.
My number five is Shaman Drum, which is... I remember it, but not fondly, because I remember being there in August without any air conditioning, standing in line for hours on end to buy books so that the professors could hang out in a place they thought was cool.
Well, we were engineers, so I had Shaman Drum on my list, but I don't think I ever bought a book there.
I was not an engineer until my upper class years. I started out as a chem major.
Got it.
I was taking LS&A classes, and I took like I took three or four, and it was just a zoo, and I resented it so much because I knew that I was paying like $30 for a paperback book so that this place could stay in business, so that people would have a fun time when they're being professors, and I was just like, I'm very mad about this.
One remnant, of course, is that, like, the Five Guys, when they transformed that, they still left the wood panel from the original Shaman Drum on State Street, so you can at least still see that. So there's a little piece, although I don't think anyone remembers why is there this weird wood paneling there.
It was I was a history major, and I got, like, 75% through two minors, one in anthropology and one in French film, and, like, all of those. All of those.
Wow.
There,
wow.
I had a French film girlfriend in like middle college, and that led, and I studied abroad, so I was already like most of the way there from like a class I took in Paris. Anyway, you watched French movies in class. It was a great class. Anyway,
blue is the warmest color.
Yeah, I've
seen that one.
A lot of Jean-Paul Belmondo. If there are any other French film fans out there, you know that guy. Anyway,
yeah.
all the books for history were like written by the professor. They were like $60, and again, Shaman Drum. So I think like a whole year of paying off my student loans was probably just for the books for Shaman Drum.
And then you could sell them back for a shiny nickel.
It makes you sound like a disgruntled grandpa.
I am. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's true.
Number four.
Are we on me? That's that Shaky Jake Woods, whose music we've been listening to. You guys remember Shaky Jake?
Yes, of course. I just didn't. It didn't occur to me to not pick a building. But that's a great pick.
Yeah, I used to love that guy. Like we would. My buddies
did
and
you,
I would just kind of go
do
and,
you
like,
have a I Break for Jake bumper sticker?
I never got one. I didn't know where to buy those. I saw them all the time, and I'd be like, where are those? Where can you get one of those things? Shaky had them. He had a T-shirt that was made for him, and he like kept that around. And like his the guy could not play guitar at all. He would just like slam on his guitar. He would just like hold it and hit it, and that was the guitar playing. But then he would just go on like these long monologues, and like it'd be hilarious. The guy was amazing.
Rishi, number four.
My number four is Old Mitch's Place. And I have to say Old Mitch's because then there was a time where there was New Mitch's, which was across the street above what is now and was then Princeton Review on the second floor. That one didn't really work, but if for everyone that remembers Old Mitch's, I'll now refer to it just as Mitch's. It was also on like floor 1.5 on the north side of South U. I think it's a university department now, but it had all these nooks and crannies. It had like $2 pitchers and Jerry Sprague, who would be one man band extraordinaire who would travel around to college towns, I think all over the country and just play. So
I recall sometimes they paid you to take the beer. They were like, we got too much of this. This is a good idea. Take it.
Dollar Pitcher Night was like on a Wednesday night too. So like Wednesday at 2 a.m. all of a sudden there would be like these rascals all over Ann Arbor who hopped up on Dollar Pitchers.
Where did I lose you?
Well, you left off fairly naturally talking about Mitch's, and we picked it up with the fact that they flooded the streets of Ann Arbor with drunks.
On Wednesday nights.
But, yeah, they had their own night, Wednesday night, and you know, it was great. Actually, I think it was Tuesday night.
Maybe it was Tuesday night.
Whichever night it was, there was the caravan from Mitch's to Backroom Pizza.
Right.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned the other pizza place at the time, which is on my list. So unless you're going to take it, don't take it.
My number four recently closed. It's Logan. It's a foo-foo restaurant, an American place that Craig Ross actually introduced me to. We met there. We got lunch. I took my wife there dozens of times. We like the sommelier would be like, hey, guys. And I'd be like, I know a sommelier kind of. It was awesome. I had the best Caesar salad of my life there. It was restaurant week, so you're not even expecting that much. You can get a Caesar salad, and you're like, this is the perfect balance of creaminess and bitterness. I understand food now. It is all open to me, and they gave that to me, and I really miss that place, even though it's only been gone a short time.
Very short. I think it was just earlier this year, right?
It's a pandemic casualty, and it's a great disappointment. Seth, you're number four.
My number three, you guys are going to hate me because I know it's probably going to be number one for both of you, is Leopold's. So we can just save it until you get. We can save it until you guys
How
get
is
around
that
to
number
that one.
Three?
He just wanted to take it. He just wanted to take it. That's 100% what happened there.
I have a good two and a good one. We can talk about Leopold's when you guys get to it because I only put it three. It's not fair that I steal your thunder.
Just let's talk about it now. Leopold's obviously was the quintessential, like the first craft brew place that I'd ever known and been to. They served it at Dominic's, you know, back in the day, and it was like the cool hangout with the games, all the stuff that every place has now. They were the place like, oh, you got to go there to do that.
Yeah, they were so cool then for doing the things that, like, you know, bars are cool for doing, all bars do now, right? Like, yeah. they were 20 years ahead of today's bar scene. And the board games were cool. The gin was really cool. There were
Leopold brothers. They were actually brothers, and one was a brewmaster, and he trained in Germany, and like they had the whole story down. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the space was a converted factory, I believe. So it's just this enormous open space. So unlike every other bar, it never got claustrophobic or sweaty. Yeah. It was open. There's super long tables everywhere, so you just kind of sat down. There's a foosball table, which was awesome. If you gave them a board game, they like just gave you drinks for the night. We brought in like a copy of Catan at some point, and they're like, "Yeah, you're drinking. Good job."
You know the space was cool because after that it was only occupied by tech companies. So obviously it was like the coolest, like most lofty, awesome brick location in Ann Arbor.
I think it sinks just a little bit for me just because it was always packed and I had just no money at that point. Like, by the time I was 21 years old, I was not. I could afford going to Ashley's once in a while, and that was mostly it.
They had like a half off night that was pretty good. So because when you got like they had like I think their standard beers were 20 ounces or 24, so you didn't have to spend a lot of money to get properly acclimated to the night.
proper drunk.
And if you're missing Leopold's, I'm pretty sure Leopold, the brothers moved to Colorado. I know this, but they moved to Colorado and they make their distillery now. So you can actually, I think you can buy their liquors online.
Yes, they started off doing brewing and they moved into distilling. They had a lot of Pisco kind of late in their Ann Arbor career, and now they do like bourbon and gin. I've actually had a fair bit of it. It's very good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely miss the old bar. Rishi, you're number 3.
All right. This one might be slightly controversial, but my number 3 is Champion House. Champion House was a Japanese steakhouse / hibachi place. Also had sushi.
Wait, was that down State Street? Like over by the, was that like by Briarwood or?
No.
That's where Avalon is now.
Okay. That is the Pretzelville building. It was where the original Pretzelville is. It's currently Avalon. It's been a bunch of stuff, but Champion House was there when I was in college and then after college. So, you know, that was it was great for, you know, at the time it was sake bombs, you know, and I guess they're gone. So I can say now, I mean, there was some underage drinking going on there as well. They were not firm on the IDs, and that was just always a great time. That was Brian's Logan for me back then. It was like, we're going to Champion House. It was like super high end. And later on in life, you know, after graduation, I would like just get sushi from there, and I got to know that owner pretty well. His name was High. And he just thought it was hilarious that I didn't own any silverware, so I'd have to ask for like plastic cups for my soy sauce, and he would just laugh and laugh and like, "Ah, bachelor, you're so funny." And like, and then one day he just up and left and went back to Vietnam, just left everything, just all the stuff, and just took off. And that was the end of Champion House. But
really? Well,
yeah, no, it was dizzying highs and terrifying lows.
Man, you gotta catch back up with that guy. You gotta paddle down a river like Anthony Bourdain. Find this dude.
I would love to find this dude. It would just be comical at best.
My number 3 also is a recent pandemic casualty. It is Miquette, a French bistro that was up by Cardamom and was amazing every time I went there. You get the French onion soup, and you're like, oh, this is just French onion soup. And then you're like, making French onion soup at home because you're just like, I can do it. You can't do it. It's not as good. Now, Monty and Isolita are still open, but I demand they bring Miquette back. I demand it. This is my demand.
I feel like stuff from the menu will show up at Monty and Isolita.
I think that's true, yeah.
Everything that I had on that menu was amazing. Spectacular. And like it got a write-up of the New York Times. I'm surprised that, you know, for a small town like us to like have like the New York Times restaurant, and they're like, close it. I know pandemic stuff, but bring also, it back.
And it was up on North Campus, which, you know, there's not really a lot of fine dining up there. So I know like that. I mean, as a, you know, as a former engineer, it's nice to get some love up there. So that was, and of course, the food was great.
Well, and that kind of, it's not really a strip mall area. It's cooler than that. Courtyard? We're going to call it a courtyard.
I believe that's the name of it. Courtyard Shops or something like that.
Well, I mean, Cardamom's up there too. So like there was like a time there where it was just like, wow, these are some great restaurants in this weird location up on North Campus.
That's true.
Seth, get over to.
So this one predates the pandemic, predates our lives, actually. It's just something that I keep coming across whenever I do all these history things with like University of Michigan history. And it's that we used to have a zoo on campus. And it was not a great zoo. It was kind of part of
really?
The it was back where they just built the new anthropology building. So like that area had like the animals were in cages. Like you could not do a zoo the way you used to do a zoo there. But they had a wolverine always. They had otters. They had turtles. They had red foxes, raccoons, snakes, two bears that were named Maize and Blue. And like the kids could like go and feed them eggs like through the chain link fences. There's a video out there. You can see like the kids like giving like full grown black bears eggs. It's amazing. But also like they had plans, I think, in the late 30s to like turn the Arb into like a full blown zoo, into like a Detroit zoo style thing. And that would have been awesome. It would have been amazing to have a zoo. I love zoos. You're looking at me weird.
Well, you just told me that Michigan is like, hey, why don't you feed this bear eggs child? And I'm like, I have a child. I can't imagine that going well enough to want to do it.
I'm going to put the video on the write-up so everyone can see it, because there is definitely video out there. It's on YouTube of like, I think it was like a University of Michigan ad for their zoo or whatever. And it's like a family with a mom and the kid and the two kids. And then all of a sudden they're putting eggs in bears' mouths. It's great.
Rishi seems momentarily mobile.
Am I back?
I was just
mobile for purposes of Seth's automatronic voice. I figured it was my fault. My number two, right?
Yep.
All right. Now we're getting to where I want to make sure I get the good ones. Okay. My number two is old Village Corner.
Okay.
So, remember, Village Corner was on South University and South Forest, and it was basically the first downtown grocery store. It had just like the most random smattering of groceries, convenience store stuff, etc. And at the end of the day, it was I'm frozen. Yeah, hopefully, you guys hear me.
We can hear you.
At the end of the day, it was completely random. It was left for a high rise, and unfortunately, it's no longer there. However, it does still exist. It's up in those courtyards on that we were just aforementioned. I think it's just a wine place now.
Well, they were reputed for having a very serious wine list like 20 years ago when that was very uncommon.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
They were.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I was just going to throw my story in for that one, because we went there when the blackout happened. You remember that? So the blackout occurs, and like we get like all the guys together, and like everyone puts their like cash together, and I send out different teams to different places to get like batteries and ice and water, because like if half the East Coast is out, who knows how long it's going to go. And the team that went to Village Corner comes back with two kegs and a whole bunch of cases, and they're like, they opened the fridge. Everything has to go. They're just giving it away. So we threw a pretty massive party with all the Village Corner's beer.
My number two is Warehouse Records, which was upstairs from Charlie's, now Cantina.
Warehouse. It was spelled
warehouse,
like,
with
yeah.
With like where, the as in who, what, why, when, how, where.
Right.
I would go there for midnight sales. I remember I got REM's Reveal at a midnight sale and then just kind of didn't listen to it and got berated by my roommate. Also, I went to a They Might Be Giants in-store performance there, where I was selected to pick out a CD near me, and then they would cover a song in the spirit of this band. I picked out Bauhaus, and everybody laughed. I didn't know why, and I still don't really know why. But It was a place where this doesn't really happen anymore. But you know, a band would be coming in for a show, and then very regularly they would show up at this place, and they would play a few songs, and hopefully get you to go to their show. So it was a relic from another time, really. I mean, Ann Arbor's had a lot of record stores that have gone bust as everybody goes to digital, understandably. But that one was the one. Like, everybody was really into School Kids or Encore, but Warehouse was the place that I really connected with.
Mine was
Seth, your number one?
My number one is, I had to make this play because this is where I worked, is the Half Ass and the Down Under.
Both of those not. I mean, East Quad exists. What?
Yeah, but I mean, now I think they're owned by like Cafe Connection, and they've moved them upstairs and like made them into like little convenience stores upstairs. Like a totally, totally different thing. Like the Half Ass used to have concerts down there. You know, people would just like gather down there and hang out all the time. There was always a haze. It was the Half Ass was just amazing, and like and then I worked in the Down Under. And it was not the same vibe, but like we kind of made it our own. It was like so far below grounds at South Quad that like pretty much anything could go, and no adult ever came to bother us. So we would invite the customers in the back and like have competitions of who could make the weirdest concoctions out of all like the hamburgers and Cokes and whatever was available. Like people would make like strange shakes, and then like we, you know, people, it was, I don't think anything in Michigan could compare to that, that vibe. I don't think that kind of campus exists anymore. So I'd miss the Half Ass and the Down Under terribly.
Rishi, you're number one.
I'm going to go with, I'm just going to go with the one that we all know and love and miss, Chinagate. Just literally the quintessential Chinese place, corner of Southview and Church, and was there for I don't know how
did
many years.
Did you live on Southview or something? Because everything you're picking is like in this one like block.
Well, you know, we're talking about establishments. We're talking about gone and forgotten. I mean, like, but not forgotten. And for me, it's about Southview. So I have, all my honorable mentions are around, but Brian, you tend to like are going recent, and I'm going back to like my youth right now. But you know, the lore of Chinagate, of course, was Chef Jan.
Chef Jan.
Like, how did Chef Jan, like Chef Jan won these awards, international awards,
yeah.
And the signs were up. I mean, where was Chef Jan, and how was he so like? How was he so? How did he win so many accolades, and yet we never saw an article about him. We never met him. I mean, like he should have been like Ari. I mean, we should know who he was, and he should have been out front and center for all of us, but he was a mystery.
I think he's a composite of various line chefs who worked there.
I think I want to believe that he's real, and he's moved on to a different Chinese restaurant in different college town.
My number one was Leopold's, but Seth stealing it from me allows me to shout out Eve, which was another hoity-toity restaurant. But I went to the hoity-toity restaurant with my wife once, and a young couple came in, and what they did is they got a plate of Eve's inspired nachos, which are like fried wonton skins with all the like fixings on top of it, which is, it's not an appetizer. It's a meal for two. And they had it. It cost them $12. It was awesome when they left, and I was like, those guys are awesome. They know exactly what they need to do. But another restaurant with the inspired chef, Eve is, I think, at Deuce now. She's also the mind behind Frida Batito's. A lot of, you know, Middle Eastern inspired flavors. She's very eclectic. She was on one of those cooking shows for a couple weeks, but she didn't work well under pressure. But she's a local, I guess you could call her a local celebrity, but her first place, which was, I think, where Miss Kim is now, was near and dear to me. I also have a couple of less serious honorable mentions. One, everything at that doomed place on Packard and State that turns over like every 3 months because it has no parking.
Oh, yeah.
And two, Middle Kingdom. I had a bet in college that I couldn't eat nothing but soup for a month. And I won that bet largely because I went to Middle Kingdom and ate their three-flavor sizzling rice soup, which was less a soup and more a smorgasbord. So thank you, Middle Kingdom. I won $20
What are we on? What are we? I missed so, it. Are we on honorable
mentions? We're talking about honorable mentions.
Yeah.
Damn. Okay.
I wanted to bring up a couple of dishonorable mentions because
dishonorable mentions.
Well, this one's honorable and dishonorable. Dynasty, which had the cheapest Chinese food in town. I mean, when I was really poor, that was like the one place I could, you know, hey guys, let's go to Dynasty. And it kind of became like the Seth thing, like, oh, damn it, that kid. But it was good. I mean, if you want to eat for under $5 and get like a full meal and feel pretty full afterwards, Dynasty was the place. I also wrote down White's Grocery, which was like they couldn't decide if
White's
they were.
Great.
Yeah, and then Taste of Italy. When I worked at Pizza Bob's, Taste of Italy was like next door, and I think B2B ended up in their spot. And I never once saw a customer go in there. And I spent like, you know, lots of time working there, and I never ever saw someone walk in. Once in a while, their kids would like come in and like borrow flour from us or something, and that was the only reason I knew that they were actually making any noodles in there. I went in and tried it once, and it was just like awful. It was like wet noodles on a plate with ketchup. So I don't know what was going on there.
Any restaurant that's Taste of Blank is a front for the mob.
Yes. It was. I honestly think it was.
I'm not sure if that's correct,
I think that they were weren't they involved in like Justin Fegan or something like that? Like,
hey, Brian, there's a new place on State Street called Taste of Zubai. It's an Indian restaurant. So go ahead and
For the mob. Where's Suvai in India?
I'm not actually sure. So
you're not actually sure?
Yeah, I know. That's sad. I shouldn't have brought it up.
No, it's a huge country. Don't worry about it.
All right. Give me some of your honorable mentions.
All right. Honorable mentions. I got Red Hot Lovers. I just thought it was a great name. Great name. On East U.
I thought, they closed?
Hot dog place.
They're now called Ray's Red Hots, and it's just not the same. But, you know, it's still a great place, but the name Red Hot Lovers, I just thought it was awesome. We're going to go some new ones for Brian, because he thinks apparently that I'm stuck on my selfie past. But
I didn't say...
Fred's became Wilma's, Fred's was on, you know, was a Sava... Lelkaj establishment, and Fred was her brother, and it was a great place, and unfortunately gone now.
Is Wilma's closed too? I think I heard that they're closing down. Wilma's?
I don't think so, no. I don't think so. Eastern Flame, which was on Ashley Street. It is where Blimpy is now. Did you ever eat at Eastern Flame, Brian?
What I did is I ordered delivery from Eastern Flame, and they called me and said they didn't have a delivery driver and I needed to pick it up.
Did you do it? Because that's how you know it was an Indian restaurant, and that's how you know it was good. Because they were a complete kind of like dive restaurant. They were good late night. So they were open till 4, but they were never staffed after 2 or after the bar rush. And so like it was just like if you had to be there, right at 2, otherwise, you weren't going to get an order. But the food was amazing, and they had these things called kati rolls, which was like a big in the big cities. But Eastern Flame was a great place. And then my dishonorable mention that I'll throw out there is there used to be fast food on campus, and there was a Taco Bell on East U, and it was next to the Melrose Place apartments. If you remember what those were, those of you that remember are smiling to yourself right now. And you know, I ate a lot of Taco Bell.
That Taco Bell was open like all night, or at least as late as I could make it. And I mean, I remember when I was on the daily, somebody wrote like a whole nasty thing about like, you know, Ann Arbor's got their own culture, and if you let Taco Bell come on, then like we were, I and like a couple other people were furious about that article because we went to Taco Bell so damn often.
All right, since we're talking about Ann Arbor restaurants, I would like to make a plea. Someone open a donor kebab. That's all.
Oh, yeah. Have you been to, we'll take it offline. We'll talk about Balkan House, though. That's a donor kebab place.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I did, because I discussed this thing with my mom, too, and she said I had to, she reminded me of a couple, and also there are a few that I had on my honorable mention list, too. Ann Arbor Sports Memorabilia, that was Kenny McGee's place, that was just like wall-to-wall Michigan memorabilia. For a history nerd, that was my thing. Arbor Ipsy Bowl, it was, We all remember the sign better
iconic than iconic sign, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Blue Front, old Blue Front. I know Blue Front kind of...
Oh, I was going to say, Blue Front
there's
is...
There's two versions.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's a third version. It was sold again. It just got rebought.
Oh. Well, original Blue Front was if Campus Corner didn't accept your fake ID, Blue Front would.
yeah, I mean, if you're in that area, Rod's Diner, that was never my jam, but Colliders were very big with a lot of people, and Espresso Royale, that was a COVID casualty, unfortunately,
they're the ones who were like, don't even bother when we mentioned the t-shirt thing to them. They're like, nope, we're closing next week. Yeah. What else was there? Fox Tent and Awning. That was the guys who used to make the banner.
So oh, yeah.
Liberty Street Video. They had like a $6 deal when I was in college, so we would just like go and rent a gazillion videos. And you didn't feel like you had to watch them all because, you know, I spent $1 per video, so whatever. We'll run it again.
Remember the Bagel Factory? Bagel Factory Apartments. The Bagel Factory was never open. It just was there. It was called the Bagel Factory, and we only knew about it because there were apartments next
door. And they didn't sell that great of bagels. Like, I come from Bagel Town, USA, over here in West Bloomfield, and we have very strong thoughts about bagels, but I remember the Bagel Factory being there. I had Moe's on my list. Oyster Bar and Spaghetti Machine was, like, my mom's major addition to the list. Apparently, like, people who were around up until the 80s, like, that was a very quirky Ann Arbor place. Made their own
Del
noodles.
Del Rio is going to be on your list.
Yeah, Del Rio. They're on there.
Del Rio.
Yeah. Yeah,
Del Rio.
What else? The old Pretzel Bell.
Touchdowns. That was an old...
Nobody misses Touchdowns. It's just Blue Lep now. It's exactly the same. They just changed the name.
I know, but you have to remember, all my things were like old Mitch's is new Mitch's and old Village Corners. So, like, you know, I'm all about the, like, transitions here. Right. But,
yeah, hey. I'm always like, oh, I had an Epicurean experience.
Yeah, I know. Apparently, we lived in different Ann Arbors in our youth that is gone and forgotten because yours is very high-end.
Yeah, my Korean place was Seoul Corner, and then Steve's Lunch. I think Brian argued with me whether that was around or not, or did they bring it back?
I think Steve's is still around, right?
I don't know. I was confusing it with the different place anyway. Rod's Diner, which actually had creditable Korean food as well.
They did, yeah.
My Greek place was Thanos, Thanos Lamplighter was.
Thanos Lamplighter is great. Mr. Greek's on State Street. Did you ever eat there?
Yep, and Zorba's. One of my friends is Greek, so that he just Zorba, wanted to go. Yeah. Zorba's a great one, and we never like to go to the Parthenon one.
the my experience at Thanos Lamplighter was like, I'm never coming back here.
It was cheap. Remember,
here's a rubbery octopus on a plate.
That was the old town Ann Arbor. That was where Bud Senior from Moe's, they all used to get together and eat there at lunch. And I heard a lot of stories about that. That was the place. So.
My cousin said Frieder used to be there all the time. That. My cousin told me a story about that place.
I just had one bad experience. I'm not saying that I mean, that was late in its run, and often like places that are about to close kind of have a drop off. And that was possibly the reason.
Now, my cousin said that when Bill Frieder was on campus, that he was like the cheapest guy in the entire town, and so he would like eat there exclusively, and basketball players would come there to meet with him. So you could always go in there and like see like a guy from the Fab Five or something, or the Yaney 9 team or whatever. Like Ramil Robinson, always at that place. I had Tower Records on there, even though it's a chain, because that was like when I came to Ann Arbor in high school. That's what my friends and I would get in the car and come to Ann Arbor for, because like it had a Tower Records. We didn't have one in Metro Detroit. I think that was my... Stucci's.
Oh, yeah. How do we miss Stucci's? I got a good story about Stucci's. They're obviously Stucci's known for Ann Arbor, but there was one Stucci's franchise not in Ann Arbor. It was in Houston. Any guesses why it was in Houston?
No.
It's because Rudy Tomjanovich was a huge Stucci's fan and opened up a Stucci's in Houston. That was the story I heard.
Huh. Okay. Well, there you have it.
And then, and finally, sushi.com.
I was gonna mention that, but I
the worst thing restaurant in history.
I thought better of myself.
We had a meeting there.
Yeah.
Oh, we
invented MGO Radio there.
I brought like my 1 year old child who was asleep the whole time.
That was next to Moe's. That's why we met there, because it was next to Moe's. That's a great place to end this. The birthplace of MGO Radio.
I think we hear the music in the background. Is that right, Seth?
That's correct. Thing is, we're supposed to talk through it so that we can get to the end of the podcast, and then
it doesn't matter. Everyone left us like 20 minutes.